Today is Friday, April 12th, 2019. It is 4:30 p.m., and this is panel number 4601, entitled Universal Healthcare, Do We Want It? Thank you for joining us. My name is Rob Vissers. I am an emergency physician for over 20 years and currently the CEO and president of Boulder Community Health. I'm going to take a minute to introduce the panelists, and then we'll get started. The format will be similar to other sessions if you've attended others. I'll give the panelists a chance to have some introductory comments, about 5 minutes each. We'll then have an opportunity for them to respond to each other. And then we'll make sure we have enough time for audience questions. I do have a few announcements as well. Unfortunately, due to the unpleasant weather conditions, the party that was scheduled today at 4:30 on the Hill has been canceled. Of course, you already chose to come here. Good choice. Having said that, several Hill restaurants will be offering an extended happy hour and other discounts, in particular to those who attended this session. All right. I'll get you the names afterwards. Okay, so let me go through their very impressive bios quickly here. First, to my left, Andrew Lehrin. Lehrin. Is it Lehrin?
Lehrin.
Good. Good. I'm trying to find my notes for you, Andrew. Here we go. So Andrew is a senior editor in the NBC News investigative team. Most recently, he led their investigation into global medical device industry in collaboration with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He spent almost 13 years as a reporter at the New York Times, working on a range of national, international, and investigative stories. One of the newspaper's lead reporters analyzing the WikiLeaks, how timely, trove of diplomatic cables, Afghanistan and Iraq war logs, and Guantanamo detainee dossiers. Highlights from these stories were compiled into a best-selling book, Open Secrets. Lehrin examined the Snowden trove of top secret spy documents, contributed to Pulitzer Prize-winning series that examined substandard Chinese chemicals tainting U.S. pharmaceuticals. Prior to The Times, Lehrin was an investigative reporter at NBC News. He's also won numerous awards, which are listed in the bio. He is also the director of investigative reporting at City University in New York, Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, where his investigative reporting class has won the Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Best Student Investigation in the nation. He has also taught at Columbia Journalism School. He earned his degree from University of Missouri and Lehigh University. And probably most important to the other panelists is he also shared with me that he's a black belt.
No, that's
Ian.
Right. That's me. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, black belt. No, this is even better. Not better. Well, at least you can run from him.
You have to be nice to him.
Yeah. So Andrew runs marathons, but not only does he run marathons, he guides blind runners. And he's done them in remote locations as far as north of the Arctic Circle. So running a marathon in adverse conditions, completely blind, there's some analogy in there around solving health care, Andrew. I'll leave that to your... all right. Next to Andrew is Reza Ramazani. Reza, let me get to your bio here or some of the highlights. Reza is a professor and former chair in the Department of Economics at St. Michael's College in Vermont, where he's been teaching international and environmental economics since 1986. Reza's research has been in the area of international trade, international finance, environmental economics, and economic development, primarily focused on China. His article has been published in various books and journals, including Review of Economics and Statistics. He is a native, interestingly, of Tehran, Iran, where he graduated with a BA in Economics and came over in 1977, is that right?
Yes.
And he also, important to you all, received his MA and PhD from University of Colorado Boulder. Welcome back.
That's the most important one, and I got to do my usual marketing for CU. Go Buffs!
Go Buffs. And he has used his alumni status to... This is your eighth or ninth time at this?
I lost track, yeah.
Yeah, lost track. And I think it's like eighth or ninth session here. What he said, he does that as his way of giving back. So thank you, Risa. Okay. Next, Ariza is Hadley Heath Manning. Hadley is the Director of Policy for Independent Women's Forum. She is a fellow of the Steamboat Institute in Steamboat. Okay. And her distinguishing fact is that she still clings to a Ford Mustang convertible, despite the fact that she's had two children in the last 3 years, and there's no way she can fit a car seat in that, so that's impressive. I was more impressed by two children in 3 years than the Mustang, by the way. But, welcome, Hadley. And then finally, Ian Milheiser. Ian is on the far left, my left. Ian is a columnist for Think Progress. He clerked for Judge Eric Clay of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, has worked as an attorney with the National Senior Citizen Law Center's Federal Rights Project, as Assistant Director for Communications in the American Constitution Society, and a Teach for America Corps member in the Mississippi Delta. Ian received his BA in philosophy from Kenyon College and a JD magna cum laude from Duke University, where I'm not going to hold that against you. I was at UNC for 7 years, where he served as a senior note editor on the Duke Law Journal, was elected to the Order of how do you say, Coif?
Coif, yeah. Coif. Yeah. It's just an arrogant thing on there.
It sounds very impressive when you can't even pronounce it.
It is meant to sound very neat.
It is, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
So not only that, but he is a black belt in Shaolin
Kempo.
Kempo, yeah.
I know Kung Fu.
He knows Kung Fu. And you know how to run. The rest of us are, in trouble. All right. Well, thank you. Welcome to the panelists. I think we're going to have a great discussion. And with that, I think we'll start in order. Is it okay? On my left, we'll go ahead and start with you, Andrew. Is that all right? And so we'll have opening comments from the speakers. They'll have a chance to respond, and then we'll get to some audience questions. So,
great. Thank you so much. I like the distance between the Duke and the UNC guys. Heard that, now I get to actually visualize it, the gap. So I'm a little bit of the square peg going into the round hole here. I'm an investigative reporter. I spend most of my time doing long-range projects, and they have included looking at the healthcare industry. So rather than, I'll leave you all to answer the fate of universal healthcare, but let me describe to you the work we do as investigative journalists looking into the healthcare system. So the last year I spent working with 250 journalists around the world investigating the medical device industry. The project began when a journalist in the Netherlands went to the grocery store, bought a bag of mandarin oranges, got rid of the oranges, cut the bag so there was just like a little swath of mesh, put together an application to European regulators and said, this is vaginal mesh. It's never been tested. It will probably kill patients. Could you please approve this for sale as a medical device in Europe? It was approved. And so she did that story in the Netherlands, but it begged the larger question, which is how much regulation is there of the medical device industry? What is actually going on in the medical device industry? To do our reporting, and this is a bit of what I want to do, is explain how we do investigative reporting. We began to hoover up documents, to hoover up data, to talk to people around the world. And we deal in what we call the verifiable truth. To put it another way, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. And so medical devices, we started checking them out. And it led us to all different kinds of reporting. The effects of the reporting you're seeing today, breast implants have been withdrawn from the market in France and in Europe. There were just hearings in the United States about breast implants. That was a result of our stories. Robotic surgical devices that have led to all kinds of problems. The FDA just announced rules recommending that they not be used in certain surgeries for the first time. That was also in the wake of our stories. But let me tell you about one story in particular that I was really intrigued about trying to pursue. So our remit is we get time to do stories. And I was really curious about what happens when a U.S. medical device company makes a device that cannot pass muster in this country. What do they do? And I was wondering, do they essentially dump it overseas? There's a reason why I did that. It had to do with earlier work that I had done. But I started wondering if this is possible. I checked the academic literature, nothing. I checked previous journalism, nothing. I started reading the rules and regulations of the FDA, and I found that there was a clause written in the late 90s on medical devices, and it created an exception for U.S. manufacturers to manufacture what they called export-only medical devices. And if you made an export-only medical device, it did not need to pass any review by the FDA, did not require any medical studies, did not require any examination whatsoever, except to say that you make it. So they could sell this around the world. Okay, that's interesting. What are the results of that? Well, that's what we went to go and check. And we found, for instance, that there were medical devices like shoulder implants being put in patients around the world that were literally imploding inside people's shoulders. These were carbon fiber devices that would implode and leave traces of fiber and, of course, a shoulder that didn't work, requiring revision surgery, which led us to learn that, guess what? Every time a surgeon needs to go in and put in another medical device, he has less bone to work with. The bone is damaged. That means there's less chance of success. We found devices designed to help you lose weight, gastric balloons that would be put inside your stomach. And what could go wrong? The balloons could break, and they could get lodged in your intestine, requiring emergency surgery, possibly the risk of death. We found other devices that would cause lesions to pancreas and liver. We found other devices that could possibly lead to deaths around the world. This was the initial story in this global investigative project. We called this particular segment Exporting Pain. But that's a little bit of a look about how we do our work. It's part of a much larger story, so if you want to look at your own, if you have a medical device you're curious about, we have a website where you can look up the history of medical devices from around the world for the first time ever. So anyway, that's a little bit of how we do our work as investigative journalists. That's one of the projects we do, and I will pass it on to my esteemed colleagues to my left.
Thank you, Andy. Good afternoon. As a typical economist, I was hoping that you folks provide me with some information or some evidence that for the first time I'm able to predict the future and not the past. Because I was just telling my colleague before we start the session, I said it's Friday afternoon, it's 4:30. Are you kidding me? There are not going to be that many people come to our session. Then in order to make my colleagues feel good, I said, well, if there are not that many people in the audience, we go with the quality and not the quantity. Thanks for proving me wrong again. I appreciate it. But the real question is, what is wrong with you guys? Now, I want to play the role of a devil's advocate today. The question in front of us is universal health care? Do we want it? The answer is very obvious to me, and I guess to all of you. The answer is?
Yes.
Good. Good, very few. See, I love to live in a free country. But as an economist, there is a follow-up question. Is it practical? Well, forget about being practical. Can we afford it? So when we ask this question, same question from American people, would you like to have universal care? The answer is yes, 70-80%. But the devil is in the detail. I'm from Vermont, and I love Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is a good man. He has a good heart. He doesn't have that many skeletons in his closet, and he's very consistent. But I don't think it's a patch of honor when someone, even like Bernie Sanders, to be consistently wrong about few issues. So when you ask people, it's not free. You've got to pay for it. we're going to raise your taxes. And I have to tell my student, free is good. I like free things, but there is nothing free in life. You're going to pay it. If you don't pay it directly, you're going to pay it indirectly. So I think that's the important question. So when I ask people, we're going to raise your taxes. But if you want to go with the precise definition of a health care for all, the government's supposed to take over every aspect of your health care, folks. And you might not have a choice to select your own physician. And when they ask the same question, but they provide people with the additional evidence, that number dropped drastically, probably from high 80, maybe to around 30, 33%. So, and again, I agree with my colleagues. A large let's look at the number, I think, here first. So, compared to other industrial countries, we spend a large percentage of gross domestic product, GDP, on healthcare. It's almost, to give you the exact number, 18% of the GDP. On average, we spend $10,000 on healthcare. Now, but also we don't get much quality, because when we talk about the quality of care in this country, according to United Nations, United States ranked number 28. So there are a lot of waste, there are a lot of problems, the system is not functioning well, there is no question, and my colleagues are experts in this area. We spend large percentage of the healthcare is not related to taking care of people's care. Okay. So there is no question there is a problem there. And also, as I said, I want to play the role of a devil's advocate. And I get it. So I want to talk about some of the advantage of this universal health care. And then I want to say there might be some unintended consequences. And then I want to talk about, look, no one has a clear answer. How much it's going to cost. And I don't know. My motto is trust but verify. I don't want, honest to God, I don't want to follow a charlatan named Reza to say, look, just trust me. It's going to work. I'm not going to do that. I want to say, I think I'm open-minded person. I'm flexible that if you provide me with the facts, and I'm not talking about the alternative facts, but I don't have any idea what the hell is alternative facts. But if someone, honest to God, this panel or any place else, to provide me some evidence, I said, well, look, you know, I was wrong. You know, we can afford it. So a couple of things. Instituting a right to health care could lower the cost of a health care in the United States. Then I want to tell you about the opposite side. The right to health care could save lives. The right to health care is an internationally recognized human right. I agree. The right to health care could make medical services affordable for everyone. Providing all citizens the right to health care is good for economic productivity. As economists, I totally agree. The right to health care could improve public health. Because of United States is a very wealthy country, coming from Bernie, wealthy country, it should provide health care to all of its citizens. Another one. Providing a right to health care could benefit private businesses. A right to health care is a necessary foundation for a just society. Agree. But let's play the role of a devil's advocate and talk about the other side. Again, being a college professor, that's my job. I got to tell the complete story. The good and the bad, and maybe the ugly. No, we gotta, even if we disagree with the opposition, and that's the problem, we have a dysfunctional government. We say, look, I'm right, you're wrong, I don't want to listen to the opposition. But folks, we gotta bring those groups together. So they have the floor, they present their point of view. Good enough? You don't want them, but we owe it to them in a free society. Give them the same amount of time to present their case, and then we're gonna make a decision. Good enough? And make a decision. Am I going to with this group or the other group? By raising our voice, by pounding a table, we're not going to make our case more clear. So now, what are the, might be unintended consequences. A right to health care could increase the U.S. debt and deficit. The right to health care could increase the wait time for medical services. Implementing a right to health care could lead the United States toward socialism. Boy, you have heard that one a lot. I don't know if I agree with that one, but, well, I have to say it. That's their point of view. I'm just delivering their message. Providing a right to health care could raise taxes. Providing a right to health care could worsen doctor shortage. The right to health care could lead government rationing medical services. A right to health care could lower the quality and availability of diseases screening and treatment. And this is very close to me because my daughter and my son-in-law are physicians. I cannot support my daughter anymore. Believe me, I have no money left. So this is the important one. The right to health care could lower doctors' earning. And there are a couple more, so I think I want to stop. But let me tell you one thing about what the economists have done, okay, the number. So you talk about the thing, this health, universal, is confusing. So let me make you completely confused by giving you a little bit of data, then I'm going to be quiet. A labor economist at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, who is very close to Bernie Sanders' election during 2016. He has done a study, folks, and he believes, according to his studies, that if we go with the universal health care, we're going to save $6 billion. In other words, good things is a cost effective. We're going to save $6 billion. Now, talk about the confusion. However, a left-leaning urban institute study come up with total opposite information. According to this study, the universal health care is going to cost us $7 billion. Now it's your choice. Take your pick. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Hadley.
Hi, I'm Hadley Manning, and was anyone in the audience at the healthcare panel at CWA last year? Because I was privileged to be on that panel. And I just had an excellent experience. Everyone at CWA, from the moderators to my fellow panelists to members of the audience, have always been so open-minded and so gracious and so respectful, even though I don't have to play devil's advocate, because I'm just going to be myself on this panel. And last year's panel was titled something like, Is Healthcare a Right? I think I was the sole panelist in the negative response. And this year's panel was titled, Universal Healthcare, Do We Want It? And similar to Reza, I had some questions about what it means to have universal healthcare, because I think we can define it several different ways. Universal access to healthcare services is one way. Sometimes people say universal healthcare and they mean universal coverage, universal health insurance, which has certainly been a focus in the past 10 years. It was one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act, at least to minimize uninsurance. And so I think my answer to the question, do we want universal healthcare, depends on what we mean by that. Of course, we all want our fellow citizens to have access to affordable healthcare services and access to the healthcare they need, regardless of their ability to pay. But I think the question really is, what is the government's role in providing this? Because that's where we're going to get to the heart of the disagreement, at least from a public policy perspective. Now, in the United States, this is a very difficult public policy area because I think sometimes good public policy and the politics of the healthcare issue are enemies of one another. And I'll give you an example. In the United States, we have a very strong connection between our employment and our health insurance. About half of Americans have health insurance through an employer-sponsored insurance plan. Well, that's not necessarily the most efficient way or the most choice-filled way to provide people with health insurance. It is a very regressive system because it means that people who have good-paying full-time jobs with benefits have easier access to health insurance. Meanwhile, people who work in the gig economy or people who don't have jobs have a much harder time finding and affording health insurance, and they have to pay with post-tax dollars, while people who have on-the-job insurance get a pretty good tax break for that. So eliminating this tax exclusion seems like a reasonable public policy step that would equalize people with on-the-job insurance and people with no on-the-job insurance. However, that's not very politically popular, especially with the people who have employer-provided health insurance or the employers who provide the health insurance as a means to attract and retain workers in the labor market. And so that's one example of why health policy can be so difficult. Another reason why it's difficult, and I do think universal access to health care services is a good goal. We ought to be sure we have the right metrics in place to understand where we are in terms of getting there. But I do think we have a very complicated system today that makes it hard for us to understand what the government's role has been and what it should be. What I mean is that we have a quasi-public, quasi-private healthcare system. We have a lot of government expenditures in healthcare, and we have a lot of private spending in healthcare in the United States. And primarily, the biggest problem in healthcare, from where I sit, is not the quality of care provided, but it's how we pay for it. And so that's, I think, where the discussion should go in practical terms. If we want our fellow Americans to have the maximum health coverage or health care, then let's talk about ways to get there. Universal is a difficult term, because I would challenge, you know, my fellow panelists and maybe people in the audience too to think about, what do we have that is universal? And even things that we have that are deemed rights, for example, the international right to health care, what does that mean in terms of what people actually get, what people actually have? What does that mean in terms of ensuring that the supply of healthcare services meets the demand of healthcare services? Because these are two very different conversations. One is more philosophical, and I think it sounds very good to say that we're in favor of universal health care or a right to health care, but it's a very different conversation to talk about what are people actually going to get under various proposals to amend our health care system. I even hesitate to call it a system. I would rather not have a healthcare system. I would rather have a healthcare marketplace. And I believe when we have, if we could have, greater price transparency in healthcare, greater consumer options in insurance and in the services that we consume, then we would have more affordable care and we would have wider access as a result. And finally, I would like to mention that I'm a graduate of the University of North Carolina. And I'm sitting right next
to
you.
Go Heels.
So I'm not sure what's worse, that we disagree on health policy or that I'm a Tar Heel, but I'll let you take your pick.
Well, so Ian, we'll let you respond to that.
Yeah, the truth is I was such a dork in high school that I only went into Cameron Stadium twice. Once was when my friend Kara graduated, and the second was when I graduated. So for those of y'all who have been to my panels before, you know that I like to start with a scary statistic, and unfortunately Reza took my scary statistic, so I'll just have to repeat it, which is that we spend more than any other nation, $10,209 for every man, woman, and child in this country on health care. And despite this fact, as Reza also noted, we rank about 28th in terms of the quality of care. So we're paying a whole lot of money for worse outcomes. And to put in perspective just how much more money we are spending, we spend more than twice what Britain, Canada, or France spends. And that's not even the most shocking statistic I have. That number I gave you, the 10,000 figure, that's all healthcare spending, private and public. If you look at just government spending, the United States government spends nearly three times as much as the British government on a per capita basis, despite the fact that the British government has an entirely socialized system. So we are getting a terrible return on our investment. And there's several reasons for this, but I got to be honest, the biggest reason is that the private insurer model doesn't work. And here's why. So if you've ever received an insurance bill, or if, you know, you probably go home and look at one, it probably looks something like this. It'll say, you know, you got an MRI. The hospital wanted to charge you $5,000 for that MRI. But we gave them $2,000 for that MRI, and then it may have a line that says that you have a copay and that you owe some money as well. But the point is that insurers provide two functions. in a system where you have private health providers. The first functions they act as insurers. They pool money together, and then when someone gets sick, money is paid out of that pool to pay for the care. But the second service that they provide is they act as collective bargaining agents on behalf of all of the people that they insure. You know, they bargain with the hospitals, they bargain with the health providers in order to bargain prices down. But in any bargaining arrangement, your ability to bargain is dependent on how much of the market you control. So if you have a private insurer that covers, say, 20% of the patients in an area, the hospital is going to listen very seriously to that insurer, and that insurer is going to be able to bargain prices down pretty low because they can't afford to lose 20% of their patients. You have another insurer that has maybe 3% of the market. That insurer is going to wind up paying more money for the exact same care because it has less bargaining power. This is also why Medicare typically pays much lower prices than private insurers for the exact same care. It's because Medicare accounts for about 40% to 50% of all health spending in the United States. And when you control that much of the market, very few doctors can afford to say, well, we're just going to lose half of our revenue because we want to be paid more for this particular treatment. So the sticker prices for care in the United States are astronomical. But the only people who actually pay the sticker prices are the uninsured. You know, as a general rule, you know, you pay a lower sticker price depending on the market share of the insurer that you use. And this is why single-payer systems tend to produce much better price outcomes. Because a single-payer system, and single-payer doesn't necessarily mean that the government pays for everything. In Canada, the government paid for about 70% of all health costs, but that is enough to significantly drive down prices because the government has such a huge market share that it can set the price wherever they want. But the problem with this arrangement is that normally you want competition because you want insurers to be able to compete amongst themselves, and the competition itself is what keeps them honest, because they, in theory, if one insurer treats people badly, people will leave that and go to a different insurer. But in this case, the more competition you have, the more expensive your health care is going to be, because the more atomized the market is going to be, the less bargaining power each individual insurer has. So you actually want a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And if you have a monopoly, you don't want the monopoly to be run by someone with a profit motive. Mm-hmm. You have to have the monopoly be run by someone who has the public's interest in mind. There are other ways to do it. You could have laws that have price fixing. You could have a private insurer and regulate it as a utility. But the most efficient way to do it is just to have a government-run monopoly. Because, again, this is one of these unusual cases in economics where monopolies are actually good, because they allow the insurer to act as a better collective bargaining agent and bargain those prices down lower. So that's the good news about single payer. The bad news about single payer is this, is that the hospitals are kind of addicted to the model we have right now. They've built their entire business model on the assumption that they can charge the higher prices that they're able to charge on our model. It affects the careers of physicians. We have more specialized physicians and fewer primary care physicians because of the way that our healthcare system is structured. It means that hospitals are more likely to spend money on expensive equipment that may be rarely used, or rarely at least need to be used. Hospitals have built their business model on the assumption that they have greater bargaining power vis-a-vis the insurers. And if you switch tomorrow to a single-payer system with the lower prices that single-payer system is going to allow, the immediate consequence will be a lot of shutdown hospitals, especially in rural regions that are the most vulnerable because they already don't have enough. So you cannot do it quickly. I believe we can get to single-payer, but you have to give health providers time to adapt their business models or there will be very serious consequences. And that's what makes this a very difficult political problem. I mean, there's many ways to do this. You could gradually lower the eligibility price for Medicare. You could gradually raise the income eligibility rate for Medicaid and also put in a federal backstop for states that have opted out of the expansion. You could put in place a public option in the Affordable Care Act exchanges and allow
allow employers to buy into that public plan. So there's lots of ways that you could gradually move us in that direction, but you cannot do it overnight. And that brings me to my last point, which is the political point. This may be a 20-year transition process I'm describing. And you can manage a 20-year transition process when you have continuity of government, or at least when you have a government that is consistently committed to the project. But if you've watched anything that's happened over the last 10 years of the fight of the Affordable Care Act, you know that what we're going to have is we're going to have a government that is sometimes committed to the project, and a government that is sometimes committed to sabotaging the project. So I believe we can get there. But the hardest problem is going to be this political problem. The hardest problem is that it's going to require a sustained commitment on behalf of the United States government, and ultimately a sustained commitment on the behalf of the voters. And that is going to be challenging, given the politics that we have right now.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is we are getting a lot of questions and a lot of interest. And if it's okay with the panelists, is it all right if I start with some of the questions and then we can have some response? Hadley, did you want
to
make response first?
Will we be able to respond to our fellow panelists' opening remarks?
Can you do it briefly?
Very briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah. One place I might quibble is with the rankings, the international rankings of the quality of care in the United States. I am concerned that some of these rankings use metrics that aren't actually the best for what care is actually provided. So what doctors and nurses and hospitals do for us is not necessarily reflected in longevity statistics or in infant mortality statistics, which weigh heavily in international comparisons. Many countries do not count as many infants as born alive as the United States. That hurts our denominator and makes our infant mortality rate look not as good. And in terms of longevity, I mean, both sides do this. But, of course, before the Affordable Care Act, Democrats would say, you know, our longevity isn't as good as other countries. And then after the Affordable Care Act, actually in recent years, longevity in the United States has ticked down. And it's, I think, largely associated with drug abuse and suicide. And these are not things that doctors and nurses can necessarily control. There's an interplay, but many things are lifestyle and culture related. I don't think it's fair for either side of the aisle to say longevity is, you know, a reflection of our healthcare system. They do it to their advantage, and these pieces weigh heavily in the international comparisons. I would say a better tool would be survival ratings for people who are diagnosed with serious diseases and cancers, and wait times in terms of access to healthcare services. And in those metrics, the United States is, I would say, if not the best in the world, one of the best in the world. So my position is still that the quality of healthcare is available in the United States. We just have a terrible method of paying for it. And that was the thing I wanted to respond to.
And very quickly, I agree with most of the things that Ian, my colleague, told you folks, but I am not 100% sure that government monopoly is better than business monopoly. I'm not very sure that's the case.
Okay. To be fair to the other panelists, any?
Oh, sure.
I'll just make two quick responses. I mean, yeah. One is like, I mean, you're right, you could do it as a business monopoly, but it would have to be an extraordinarily heavily regulated business monopoly. You know, you could do it like you do an energy utility. To your point, you know, you're right that it's very difficult to disaggregate cultural factors and, you know, social factors that are unrelated to the quality of care that people are providing in order to rank nations. It is still also the case that we spend many, many more dollars per capita than any other nation. And so, you know, if it turns out we are actually third, that's still a terrible return on investment when you consider how much more we're spending than any other nation.
It could be, too, that other nations benefit from our investment, though. you know, that as Americans spend more on advancements and innovations that are ultimately export. I mean, in terms of Nobel Prize winners in medical innovations, we co-own many with the European scientists, but America is the home of medical innovation, and I think we pay a high price for that. But there's, you know, get what you pay for in some cases.
All of a response. Let's move on to questions.
Okay. Yeah. Ian and I can quibble later.
There are a number of questions that are themed around a particular area, so I'll pick one of the student ones. But and this is really asking you as panelists, maybe we are for or against universal health care, which probably has a number of definitions. So I think the push is, the question is, there are a number, at least the question here, is a number of health systems in other countries that are performing better than our system. And if you were to pick another system, what would it look like? Would it look like the Swedish system? Would it look like the Canadian system? So that's a question to the panelists. And there's a number of questions here that are themed around, if others are doing it, why can't we do it?
I think we can, one of the, I think, concern I have with the universal health care, when the government completely take over, and as a citizen, they lose the freedom of choice. I've been in this country long enough, I know how much American compared to other countries value that personal choice. They want to make the decision, especially in this area, as what kind of a doctor they want to have as a personal physician. Now, in Europe, we have universal health care. The government is in charge, but also as a citizen, I believe you have a freedom to have additional health care. And I have no problem if we use that kind of a universal health care, that government can provide quality health care to everybody. But in addition, I want to have that freedom if I want to visit or have another doctor. Same things with the higher education in this country. We have public colleges and university, but if you want to send your daughter or your son to a private school, you have that freedom. And I think that, I think, is a definition that I can live with, because I think that individual freedom, I think, is important. And if you want to get rid of completely the private insurance companies, that's going to have some unintended consequences, because 500,000 workers for work that industry, and that industry generate probably $1 trillion, you know, every year. And this is a very revolutionary changes in the healthcare in this country, and the healthcare is 20% of our economy. And besides, like Ian mentioned, and I totally agree with him, and I don't think there is really the political courage or is there for us to do what Bernie Sanders is suggesting. So I like the model of healthcare in Europe, because yes, government is in charge, but at the same time, the citizen have a freedom to have additional healthcare.
So I'm going to give a somewhat unsatisfying answer, which is, it depends on when you are asking me the question. And what I mean by that is, one pattern you see in developed nations is the sooner they decided that it was time to have a universal healthcare system, the more the government is involved in that system. I think the British did it first, and they have their socialized hospitals. You know, at the nation that I think waited the longest before us, I think, was the Swiss, and they have the most privatized system next to us. And the reason for that is that all the problems I described in my opening remarks, where like health prices are really big if you have an atomized insurer market, the other thing is that health inflation is really high. So for each year you wait, healthcare winds up eating up more and more of a share of your GDP, and that makes it politically very difficult to then move to a universal model, because as it swallows up more and more of your GDP, that means that at least initially you have to pay much higher taxes in order to in order to pay at the rates that the market is providing at that point in time. So the United States is going to have a tough road because we've spent so much time. If I had the opportunity to set something up in 1940, I don't know if I would have matched the British system, but I might. But I probably would have. Looked to something towards a very generous single-payer healthcare system. I think that given that we have waited so long, I think that our single-payer health system would have to be less generous, and that's not the end of the world. Like I said, in Canada, 30% of health costs are still paid by the private sector, and they still pay half as much as we do. So you can still have a very good healthcare system without having the sort of generosity that I think Bernie Sanders wants to have in his proposal. But because we have waited so long, and for the reasons I stated before, it's going to be very difficult to get there, and it's going to require a kind of dialogue with the health industry where you do something, and then the government uses its leverage to bring prices down a little bit, and then once the industry has adapted, you do a little more, and you just have to keep doing that until you get to your end point.
Any other comments? Anybody picked a country they want to go get their care at? No? Resort.
I'll stay here.
Okay, good. There are a number of comments as well and questions that are, and I'll read one, but most of them are themed around the idea of we're already spending so much more than others that they're questioning the argument that it's too expensive to go to another system when these other systems cost less. And so one question is around when it said universal health care will raise taxes, isn't it just a matter of moving the dollars around? We already pay for the uninsured through higher insurance premiums and for Medicaid through taxes. And then there's an associated question about, and compared to that, what's the cost of continuing with the current system? So some questions around this premise that we can't afford to move to a different system given how expensive it is now.
I think that's a great question and a great argument, assuming that if we move to the new system, we're going to make it more efficient. See, I go back to the question that I mentioned when Ian mentioned that government monopoly apparently is better than the business monopoly. And I have a problem with that, folks. You know, and again, it's based on my past experience. And maybe I'm cynical because I see some inconsistency. And again, I think I want to make it very clear. It's my opinion only based on my experience. I haven't seen a government that always do what they say. I tell my student, I have been around the block 3 or 4 times more than they did. So they have done it. They have been, but I want clear evidence that if we move from business monopoly to government monopoly, we are able to become more efficient. But that is a very good question. We are wasting a lot of money in the healthcare. There is no question about it. But I don't know if we move to the single healthcare, we are going to be any better. I'm afraid, you know, we're going to do the same thing as usual, but we're going to get that freedom of choice from our citizens. That's my fear.
So I think that the distributional consequences of shifting from the model we have now to a government-run model, if you assume that at least initially it'll cost the same number of aggregate dollars, are pretty significant. And here's what I mean by that. So the winners in our current system are people over the age of 65 because they already have Medicare, and young people because young people tend to be healthy. And so they don't need as much medical care. The losers in our current system are people who are maybe in their 50s, who are more likely to have more medical issues than younger people, but haven't yet qualified for Medicare. And so if you move from a model like the hodgepodge we have, where it's a mix of taxes and tax credits and private, you know, private citizens paying premiums and, you know, employers provide, to one where everything is just done through taxes, what you would essentially be doing is you would be taxing, or you would move to a system where the winners would be the 50-year-olds, which would mean that you would be taxing retirees and you are taxing young people at the beginning of their career in order to subsidize people at the peak of their earning power. And that strikes me, you know, even if you believe that that's a fair thing to do, that strikes me as a difficult political puzzle to put together. And so, again, that doesn't mean that you can't get there. But in order to get there, this is another reason why I think you can't do it all overnight. If you move everything over to the tax ledger, you will eventually make the system cheaper, but there will be a transition period where you're going to wind up taxing less financially secure people to pay for more financially secure people, and you have to have a way to manage that transition, or it's just not politically going to work.
So another theme that's coming out of the questions speaks to some of the other costs of healthcare, and what is highlighted is medical devices, pharmaceuticals, the cost of the insurance industry, and the administrative burden of our current system. And one of the student questions that speaks to this is, and I think you could probably extend it more broadly, will insurance companies ever let us enter into universal health care? How will we get past the lobbyist power?
The answer is absolutely not. They are protecting their profits. When we talk about, especially when Bernie Sanders is talking about getting rid of a private insured industry, an industry that create 500,000 jobs, and the revenue is around $1 trillion. I'm going to ask the audience, if somebody want to get rid of your business, how do you react?
Wrong business, get rid of it.
Well, then let's assume that's the case. I totally agree with that statement. See, that's one advantage being a college professor. We have to be ready for a different point of view, and you are not supposed to get upset and, like some politicians, start pounding the board. That's, I think, is absolutely a good response. I appreciate you said that. But then, as I said, is going to disrupt our economy, because 20% of a U.S. economy is healthcare. Are we ready? Are we willing to pay the price for that kind of a disturbance that we're going to create? I have no problem, but I want to make sure that we should not draw a very rosy picture that the transformation is going to be painless, is going to be very quick. Ian already explained, because of a lack of a political courage, is going to take us at least 20 years to make the complete transition. So it's going to be painful, it's going to be a time-consuming transition, and that's the key, is transparency. As a charlatan politician named Reza, I got to come clean and not make those promises that these changes are going to take place overnight. I have to tell you, yes, we might improve the healthcare in this country, but it's going to take some pain and suffering, and it's going to be a time-consuming process. And then I have no problem. You folks give me the time that I make the adjustment and move from the wrong industry and do something that is right and is just and is ethical, I'll be happy to do it.
But isn't the 20% going to continue to go up?
Yes, it's going to up. But we are saying at least, because we don't know that the change is going to make the situation better or worse. That's the reason I don't have any evidence. And I don't want to take the risk.
Right, and we would ask that if you could post the questions, which was one of the questions posed, is what about the sustainability of the current system? But Hadley,
if I can make a couple sort of political observations about some of the last couple questions, because we were asked about lobbyists and special interests and the cost of Medicare for All or single payer in whatever form. I do think that often much to, you know, much as a problem as this is for people on the political right or for conservatives. This is often put forth as a debate about single payer and how wonderful it would be versus the costs of it. And Raisa mentioned some of these concerns about costs. How are we going to pay for it? And that is one of the knee-jerk responses from Republicans about single payer all the time. How are we going to pay for it? But I think that is a losing argument for Republicans, because that really pits people and care for human beings against dollars and money. And my position is, even if we could afford single payer, or even if the model suggests that we would save money with a single payer system, we still wouldn't buy it. My position is, it's not a great thing that we wish we could buy if only we could afford it, but it's something that comes with unintended consequences for the care that we receive. And so I think that's one word of caution I would make to people who are not big fans of single payer, would be not to focus on the cost piece. Because on the other hand, this is a political point, if we're counting on the government or the government monopoly to do cost control, there's a couple of concerns that I have about this. Number one, I do not think that negotiation is a fair term to use when you've got the government sitting across the table. If there's a government monopoly negotiating with providers about what rates they will pay, that's price setting. That's not negotiating. And another piece of the cost control that's a concern is that our government has not demonstrated a good track record on cost control, especially when it comes to health care. In Medicare, we had for many years something called the doc fix, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but every year there was supposed to be a time where the Medicare sustainable growth rate hit and doctors would take a big pay cut. And you know what Congress did every year? They passed a doc fix bill to help avoid this. And so I'm very skeptical that our government, as a monopoly over healthcare or in whatever form, is all of a sudden going to have this epiphany that, hey, you know, we've never done this before. We've never, you know, set rates that would make healthcare more affordable in the past. But now we're going to forget about the political incentive to please, you know, doctors and hospitals and providers and the patients that they see, because access is improved when those rates are higher. We're just going to walk away from all that and suddenly become very responsible with the taxpayers' dollars. So I think those are a couple areas of concern, because certainly how much it costs is one concern, but I think there are bigger concerns about how the money flows through this system, because how we pay for things matters. And the Affordable Care Act did change how we pay for a lot of things. It used essentially private insurance as a big holding tank for money that socializes the cost of health care. I don't think, you know, Democrats weren't politically able to go to a single-payer system in 2010, so they socialized the cost of health care through insurance. And Ian talked about some of the roles that insurers play in our system today, but one additional role that they play is that they are third-party payers, even in many cases in the healthcare system where they would not be considered insurers. Insurers in other sectors help you as a backstop against unexpected costs, and in healthcare, insurers are often involved in paying for the first dollar for much of the care that we consume, even preventive care, things that we could pay for out of pocket if we had a marketplace for those things. So my word of caution about the payment is not just that it's a dollar sign or a price tag that goes with single payer, but that because of the way the money flows through a system like this, the incentives are going to change, and that could come with very high costs in terms of the care that patients can access, when and what quality, and that's the greater concern rather than the price tag.
So I want to, I guess, respond to some of your points about, like, price controls, because, like, I mean, like, I accept the hit that what I am talking about is the government controlling prices, and here's why I think that's the least worst option.
Okay.
So the model that we normally use to control prices is markets. You know, the model that we normally use is that consumers go out into the market, they learn enough about different competing products that they can decide which one they like the best, they figure out who's offering the best deal at the lowest price, and they're able to make that judgment on their own as to who's doing a good job. And, like, this is something that we can often do with really complex products. When I bought a car, I drove the Honda, I drove the Toyota, and I looked at consumer, and eventually decided I liked the Toyota the best. And so markets work for setting the prices of cars. Markets do not work for setting the prices of health care. Mm-hmm. And there are several reasons for this. One reason is just the incredible information disparity between doctors and patients. You know, if my doctor tells me I need a $50,000 surgery, I'm not going to argue with them because I don't have the information, either the information to know whether I need that surgery or not, or the information to know whether it should cost $50,000, and I would have to go to med school to get that information.
Still wouldn't know about the price.
Yeah. The other reason is that, so one of the driving forces of lower prices is basically people figure out ways to make inferior products for significantly less money. So like this shirt I'm wearing right now, I think I got this for $40 at Macy's. There is a bespoke tailor about a block from my office that would make me a much, much better shirt for like maybe $280. But like this shirt is fine. Like it does what I need in a shirt, so I choose the inferior product. But if my doctor comes to me and says, well, we've got this problem. You've got cancer. And we've got one treatment that has a 60% chance of saving your life. And another treatment that only costs a tenth as much, but it has a 30% chance of saving your life. No one's going to choose the cheaper option. The market mechanism where we intentionally select into inferior products. Again, I drive a Toyota and not a Lamborghini. The market mechanism where we intentionally select into inferior products does not exist, at least to the same degree, in the healthcare market. And so the reason why you need the government to play a greater role in setting prices is because health markets simply do not function like nearly every other market. Like all the Econ 101 stuff that you learned in college does not apply to the healthcare industry, and so we can't rely on market mechanisms to do what they do in other industries.
Thank you. At this point, we have hit our time. Thank you, Ian. Thank you very much, panelists, for your compelling comments and insight. This is clearly a topic that resonates. We are inundated with passionate questions and comments. And so thank you all for attending. Thank you, panelists.
Yeah, this one's just an hour.